This week on Snark Squad Pod, we're joined by Amanda McLaughlin and Connor O'Brien to talk about The Subtle Knife by Philip Pullman. Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. My name is Mani Ness.
My name is Nicole Sweeney, and we are joined this week by Amanda and Connor.
Hey, I'm Amanda. I am the head of Multitude Productions, which is a podcast collective and production company, and I'm very glad to be here.
Hey, what's up, you guys? It's Connor, and I have a YouTube channel named just Connor O'Brien, where I primarily review fantasy books.
Amanda and Connor are here continuing our journey through the Historic Materials books. Our friend Sarah, who joined us last time, couldn't make it, but Amanda also read these books as an actual child, so she graciously volunteered to step in and fill that very important role in our Historic Materials read-through. So this book, The Subtle Knife, is the second book in the trilogy, and we start out not in Lyra's world, but in our world, essentially, where we meet Will Perry, a boy who's about the same age as Lyra, who lives with his mother, who she's not well. Will is in some kind of danger, and so he finds a safe place for his mother to stay, and then goes back to his house to collect some important documents of his mother's that belonged to his long-lost father. But while he is looking for the documents, some mysterious men break into his house, and as he is fleeing, he accidentally kills one of them. While he is on the run, he happens upon a mysterious window in the air that turns out to be a window into another world. In this other world, Will meets up with our girl Lyra, and while the two of them are sort of like initially suspicious of each other, they're very bizarre circumstances, like they're both in a world that is not their own, thrust them together, and most of this book is about that friendship. We learn that Lord Asriel was not the first person to create a way in and out of the other worlds, which is how the last book ended. And in fact, this other world that is neither Will nor Lyra's used to be like the way station between the worlds, because it was in this world that they invented a knife, the subtle knife that the book is named after, that can cut through any surface in the universe, including the fabric between the worlds. This other world is infested with these like ghastly creatures called specters that prey on the demons of adults. And so it's largely a world of orphans. Will and Lyra are forced to acquire the subtle knife after Lyra's alethiometer is stolen in Will's world. And Will winds up being a chosen one with the knife, kind of in the same way that Lyra was with her alethiometer. The two are chased by other children in this world because they also wanted the knife, because the specters are afraid of the knife and probably can be killed by it, although we don't actually see that happen in this book. Will and Lyra are saved by the arrival of the witches, who we learned had left their world in search of Lyra in order to protect her. Also headed their way are Lee Scoresby and Stanislaus Grumman, who we only sort of heard about in the first book when Lord Asriel supposedly brought his decapitated head to the scholars. That was not his head. He is very much alive. And he is a shaman. And Lee went to him because he heard that Grumman had this cool ass weapon that could protect Lyra. Grumman basically summoned Lee so that he could go find the guy with the cool ass weapon. They go on their whole little side quest that does ultimately lead them to almost leads them to Will and Lyra. Lee dies protecting Grumman, and Grumman finally finds the bearer of the cool ass weapon and realizes that the sort of, you know, big mission that he was coming to entrust to the keeper of the cool ass weapon, that is actually his son. He is Will's long lost dad. And basically as the two of them realize this, he dies. So that's unfortunate. That's how their side quest ends. Will had gone for a walk when he ran into Grumman. A lot of stuff was going on all at once. But when he comes back, he finds that Lyra has been kidnapped. And he meets two angels who are like want to take him on a mission, basically the same mission that Grumman came to entrust him with. I think the only, what else did I miss? Oh, Mrs. Coulter was making all sorts of mischief in this book. We only...
Just getting people drunk all the time.
Yes. She's getting people drunk. That's like her main project in this book. Lord Asriel is building some kind of army in another world. We mostly learn about him through Ruta Scotti, who is another witch that we meet in this book. I think the only other key detail that I left out is Mary Malone, who we also meet in this book. She's a scholar in Will's world who is studying dark matter. Lyra meets her and basically helps her figure out how to use a computer similarly to the way that Lyra reads the alethiometer. The computer tells Mary to like burn her life down and go on the run. And she's like, cool, sounds great. And she also goes through the window that Will found. And I think that's all the essential plot threads of this book. There's a lot. This is the middle book in a trilogy. So there's a lot of stuff in the air as we kind of expand this world.
Now, you have two Irish people here. Connor, do you also have an aunt called Mary Malone? Because I'm pretty sure I do.
I do not.
I'm pretty sure she also ran off to join a convent and like listen to the angels. So this really hit home for me.
Okay, well, I'm not sure that I felt like it, so much happened while I was reading this, but we'll come back to that. Right now, we're going to start where we always start, and that's with the question, did you like this? So, Amanda, do you like this book?
I medium like this book. I like the way that it leaves us in setting up for the Amber Spyglass. And when I remembered reading this book 10 plus years ago, all the parts that I remembered loving are actually in the Amber Spyglass. So that is my reaction. I was like, cool. So when does Mary like redacted, redacted, redacted? And then I was like, oh, wait, no, that's the other half of Amber Spyglass. So I thought it was interesting. There are parts I like. There are parts that I found a little bit less less exciting. But I would reread it, I think, in a reread of the series. I wouldn't necessarily go back for just this book like I do all the time for Golden Compass.
I have similar thoughts. I feel like this one is such a change in like pace and plot as the than the first one was. So it was kind of jarring going from that one to this one where, I don't know, I feel like she was traveling with a bunch of like older people and just learning about her own world. And in this one, we're kind of learning about all the worlds at one time and all of the terminology is all flying all over the place. I enjoyed it, but like I think I liked the first one more, but I haven't read the third one, so I don't know.
I enjoy this book, but mostly because I love this whole series so much. And so it's a little bit hard for me to separate out my feelings for the series as a whole, to identify what my feelings are for this specific book. Like Amanda, though, I do often forget what things happen in The Subtle Knife versus The Amber Spyglass. And like, yes, most things actually happen in The Amber Spyglass. And this book is very much a lot of setup to get us to that point. I care about a number of things that happen in this book too much for me to not like still love it, but it is definitely the weakest of the three.
Mm-hmm. I read this originally 7 or so years ago, and it was a very tough experience for me when I first read it. I think part of it was the framing of me coming into these books, both knowing that they were some of Nicole's favorite, and she had like practically like, okay, it talks about religion a lot. So I was like, I don't know, going in defensive a little bit. And this book turned out to be a lot more heavy-handed with that stuff than the first book. So my entire experience with it was more negative my first read through, and some of the key things that were present in the first book that I loved were not here. And so it was like the double whammy of like being slower, more heavy handed, and like you don't even have an armored bear. Like, come on. But in rereading this, I found, you know, that I approached this book a lot more differently this time around. I appreciated a lot more of the elements here. I loved Will a whole lot more. So I just had like an overall like more pleasant experience coming from it, you know, 7 years later and knowing the end and all of that. So I bumped my star rating up like 1.5 stars from like 7 years ago, because I was like, no, man, I love this. What was I thinking? So,
I mean, yeah, the computer scene alone is worth it to me. You know, there's so much that we find out, but there are really, for me at least, some moments of like arm hair raising, you know, excitement.
Yes.
Literally everything Lee Scoresby in this book is like, oh man. Yes.
I think that I mentioned like in my struggles the first time around was partially in my like, Will? Who is Will? I already have a Lyra kind of thing. And
I have one. I don't need this new kid.
Thanks. No thanks. But so we're going to talk about Lyra, obviously, because she's still central here. But we do get introduced to Will Perry, and he is a main character. And I'm curious what you guys think about Will and his introduction and him set up against our girl Lyra, as Nicole said.
In our book club, even before I started reading, I sort of posed as a question, like, I'm really excited to hear how first-time readers react to Will in particular, because, like, I don't know, I, having read the book so many times, like, I adore both of these fake children as though they are my actual children. I don't know. I don't have actual children, so I don't know. But I love these fake children very much. And I had this vague sense of like having that reaction to Will upon first meeting him, but I couldn't really remember or couldn't distill it down. So I was like, you know, like maybe somebody can, you know, tell me like, what's the point where you cross over and you like love Will? And so I was sort of looking for it when I started reading the book, and it's literally on like the second or third page that the book is like, Will loved his mother fiercely, and my reaction is sobbing. So I
my son.
Yeah.
Right.
His protectiveness of his mother, his fierceness. I think it is really interesting how he functions as a foil to Lyra, their sort of balance. She is sometimes secretive, mostly on accident, whereas like he is secretive very much on purpose. He's super secretive. He's quiet and fierce, and you know, she's super chatty. And I don't know, like their dynamic is very lovely and sweet. And I really love this fierce little boy who loves his mother so much.
Yeah, he's also very much like protecting the stuff that he has, whereas Lyra, I think, is all about like discovering more for herself and taking what should be hers, whereas Will is just trying to like go to sleep tonight safer than he woke up, which I think is so like moving and beautiful, how their kind of competencies and the ways in which they're brave complement each other and come out in different ways. Like, you know, you think Will is kind of, or his bravery, I guess, is defined early on in like subtle ways, and in just in persistence, whereas Lyra, you know, begins with like giant actions and like falling and hiding and stealing and all this stuff. So for me to see them really support and show up for each other, even though they meet so suspicious of one another and in kind of like antagonistic circumstances, was really lovely this time around, knowing where they end up.
That point about like Will being protective of what he has, you know, especially as compared to Lyra, who is like claiming things and like things that are rightly hers, it's also really interesting in terms of their backgrounds. Obviously they grew up in, you know, very different worlds, but like, you know, Lyra, even though she didn't know her true parents, like she knew she was a, you know, noble born child, right? Yeah. Whereas Will is essentially like taking care of, this is a 12-year-old boy who is taking care of himself and his mother, basically. So, you know, those very, very different life circumstances also shape this, the two ways that they're, as you put it, that their bravery manifests.
Definitely.
I think the scene that really sold it for me, and the thing that I both love and hate about Philip Pullman's like writing, is that he does everything pretty slowly and deliberately, even though there was a ton of action here and a lot of it was dark. And you know, I there were moments that I was just completely overwhelmed by the action that was happening. But his world building is like really slow and deliberate. But there was a scene that literally Will is just cooking an omelet and he knows how to do it. And Lyra's like, what? And, you know, it's like the difference between, you know, their worlds, but also the difference in the ways that they're raised. You know, they're both parentless for all intents and purposes, but the way that Lyra was raised was very different than what Will was doing, you know, scrounging a life together, laying low, trying to make sure that nobody is seeing him blending in. And, you know, there's a lot of like survival and maturity there in a very different way than Lyra's. And what better way to like show that, show the reader that immediately than like her being like, what's a can of beans? And how do I eat? I don't know. So I just love that scene so much for what it established right off the bat about these two characters.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one as well, especially just because like he's like, well, you can clean up the dishes. And she's like, well, I'm not a servant. And he's like, you are now. Like, clean it up. I think the one point that I jumped onto Will's side, besides when he was like, I love my mom, I was like, I love my mom too, was when Lyra decides that she trusts him. She asks the lithiometer, and it's like, he's a murderer. And she's like, yep, he's good for me. I like this. I was like, you know what? If he's good for you, he's good for me too.
That moment is so charming. And I just, the fact that she's like, a murderer, perfect. Like, I loved it so much. And I loved it in like the ideas of Lyra is separated from a lot of the cast that she was with in the first book, but she keeps bringing them up. Like, if Yorick were here, mm-hmm. and if Mr. Mm-hmm. Scoresby were here, and these are the people she trusts, and they're all, you know, they're kind of killers too. So the fact that she meets this other little boy and the lithiometer is like, totes a murder, and she's like, my people, let's go.
Some of my favorite people are murderers.
Yeah. Because Lyra is with Will and off on this new adventure, I think we see a little bit of a change in her character as well. And her adventure kind of takes a backseat to Will's in the story and his quest to find his father. And I had trouble with that, like probably more in my heart and in my feelings and in my desire for Lyra to still be out there on her own adventure. But, you know, I can reason it away in my head. How did you guys feel about like the change in Lyra?
I liked seeing her initially in a role where she was sort of less equipped and less comfortable. I think that's a really interesting place for a hero or someone that we love in a series to be, like kind of out of their element. Like Lyra has just kind of mastered, like we know she's a good adventurer. We know she can hold her own in like the Arctic, you know, in these awful like camps in Oxford. She can do it all. But here, you know, she really does need to take someone else's lead, which I think could be a really good like character growing moment. But actually for me, I was a lot more kind of skeeved out by the prophecy angle this time around. Like seeing these kids kind of cast into the sort of Adam and Eve stereotype or story like plotline, I think was troubling, because I just want to see them like love each other and live their own lives and be independent people who have like the resources that they need to live full lives, instead of being cast into this like metaphysical, you know, religious drama that's like bigger than they are, and have them just become figureheads. So that part, my heart was like, no, like, no, like, I don't want Lyra to be special. I want her to be a normal person. Like, isn't that what we all aspire to? So I was very kind of swept up in that this time around.
I was kind of on the same thing with Madi. I was like, kind of disappointed that she took a little back of a backseat. I see why that she wasn't as equipped, and I understand that struggle, but I still wanted her to like be like calling the shots and leading the charge and everything like that. I especially didn't like it when like the role completely reverses and Lyra's like, okay, you're in charge. I'm not doing anything until you say it. I'm not checking my lithiometer to make sure that we're doing the right thing. Not until you tell me to check it, I'm not going to check it. And I was like, no, girl, check your lithiometer. That's why you got it.
That's mostly where it was. I think that was the moment when she was like, in the past, I would have checked this. And I know that the story wants you to see this as like a moment of growth for her. And she really feels bad for the way that she, you know, messed up. And she didn't listen to the alethiometer the first time around. So this is almost her penance. And I get that. But I was the same as Connor. I was like, check that thing. Ask your questions. Like, I don't know why this is a thing. Like, nobody needs to know. Just check it. But you know, whatever, good on her.
And then there's also where she's like, Pan is the one that's saying like, let's do this, and she's like, no, I'm not doing anything. I'm like, just do it, like, just follow him.
Pan also thought it was a bad idea to hide in the scholar's room in the first scene of the first book, so if we all listened to Pan, it would be a lot chiller.
There is a lot less Pan in this as well. And I think that the whole idea of like the souls that we start discovering in book one, we see a little more of that discussion here with the witches and their demons. And also we find that John Perry has a demon that can go far away from him. And then Lyra's first reaction to Will when he doesn't have a demon is like, oh, this is weird. And so kind of getting to the place where she thinks maybe she's convinced his demon is on the inside. And so that idea of her being able to make that connection was really interesting to me. But also, anytime I start thinking about the soul thing, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what it means. I don't want to think about this too much.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I understand that reaction to not wanting to think about the soul thing too much. I don't know. To me, I only think about it kind of in terms of like how it's serving the story. I sort of mentioned this in the last book. There's like, I am like really deeply disinterested in what Philip Pullman was trying to say. Like, I don't care. Super don't care.
Word.
I care what is like useful or meaningful or interesting to me to extract from this, right? So like as far as the soul stuff is concerned, I think like my interest in it is strictly wrapped up in these, like, I don't know, like the world building questions and this idea of Will being super lonely and like the way that the demons are used in the story to juxtapose Will's loneliness with Lyra's relationship with Pan and like all of that kind of stuff.
I think that in the first book, we get a lot of that idea of like why it's awesome to have a demon and like, you know, she's never lonely and he's there like as a counselor, almost as a conscious. And you see in some of the adults, the way that there's almost a partnership. You see that a lot with Lee and his demon. I thought that was a really neat relationship. But you also get in this book a lot of like why it's almost also a weakness to have an external soul. And we see this, you know, because of the witch and like that who she dies because her demon is like entrapped. And you see this with that one person. There's like a million people with one of the people that Mrs. Coulter gets drunk and the golden monkey is like stroking his demon. So the ability to like interact with your demon on the outside is almost a weakness for people here.
It also comes up with Lee, not so much as like an actual weakness, but like the potential for weakness, because he is frequently sort of, you know, thinking, it's cool, Hester is gonna like squint her eyes and so she'll be inscrutable, but like, you know, like this idea that, you know, when you're that your demon can sort of give you away in some fashion.
Everyone with a demon feels so self-assured to me, though. Like, that is one of the things that sticks with me from reading this book as a kid. Like, man, if I only had a demon, like, they could, like, I could see in them the other parts of me by, like, negative example. You know, like, Pan is cautious because Lyra is bold and he is, you know, gender is not binary, but, like, they're the female and the male. Like, there's this whole idea that all the parts of me that I maybe don't want to see or can't identify, like, I would have to confront when there was like their opposite or their complement standing right in front of me. And so to me, that's like, yes, Will is lonely, but he also has to be like self, I don't know, aware, self-assured in a way that Lyra only is in conversation with Pan. And so I don't know, that to me was so like moving, looking at the cover of my copy of the book anyway, from 1997, has Lyra on the front with Pan as a cheetah or jaguar. I can't tell them apart. And then Will with a cat in his arms. And so I think it's funny that they chose this because they don't want to give away the fact that Lyra's talking to somebody without a demon or a visible one on the cover, presumably. But like, Will doesn't need that other part of him outside of himself. Like he's a remarkably self-assured boy and a boy from like our modern world. So I don't know. That's a little demon thing that I was noticing throughout the book. Like, who needs to kind of put their hand on their demon to feel whole versus like, what do those of us without that example do? Like, how do we develop that kind of sense of self-assuredness?
Mm-hmm. The only thing with that is I think about the scene where Will is freaking out and can't figure out the knife, and then Pan goes over and touches him.
Yeah.
And later on, Pan's like, he needed a demon, blah, blah, blah. So it was like, I don't know what I'm trying to say. But like, he doesn't have a demon and he had to borrow one to like calm himself down.
It's interesting. We talked a little bit about like how the was a moment where Pan and the golden monkey in the first book like were like at odds, and that idea of like Lyra's very soul rejecting Mrs. Coulter's soul. So that moment, I think, spoke more to me about like the way that Lyra and Will were, I don't know, bonding. Connecting. I don't know if that's the right word, but they're like the connection between the two of them is that when, you know, Will needed comfort that Pan was there, and Pan felt comfortable enough. We're reminded again and again and again what taboo it is to put your hands on somebody else's demon, and the fact that Pan was just like, oh man, he needs some comfort, and like, you know, went over and started licking his, or whatever he did. You know, I thought that that was more, it like spoke more to me about the connection there between the two of them.
Yeah, they become sort of family by necessity.
If I had a demon, I'd share it with you guys.
Oh. True friendship.
I will say I was especially sad in the one scene because the external demons being a weakness when the one guy doesn't let go of Lee's balloon and they get ripped apart because he's flying and the husky can't fly, and I was like, no, the husky.
I have a husky. Because it's so painful.
There were a lot of scenes in this one that I thought were really painful. Like one of the early scenes is of a witch getting tortured. And yeah. I had like a visceral nope reaction, like while reading that, where I think the first book, I mean, it had its dark moments too. I think the Bullvanger scene where Lyra's about to get cut off from Pan is like one of the ones that really sticks out in my memory. Here, there were several where I was like, I don't want a no, like fingers being chopped off. I don't know. There was just a lot of like darkness and violence in this one. A lot more, it felt like to me.
And this was like Order of the Phoenix, but in book two, it was a lot to handle.
Well, yeah, because there's all the specters and they're like sucking away people's souls, and so that was like constantly happening to every person that
the specters, yeah, that was really creepy and weird, and the whole eeriness of the like in-between world where it's just a bunch of kids running around with like ghosts all around them that they can't see that stole all of their parents, like that's some dark shit, man.
And oh, I'm so excited to hear y'all react to Amber Spyglass too, because there are so many ways that this sets us up for what's going to happen in the third book, and also ways in which it like completely does not prepare you at all.
Yes.
And there's that one kid who's about to like become an adult, and he like has like an aura around him of all the specters because they're just waiting for him to like old enough to reap his soul, and I was like, don't show it.
Well, I mean, the story is in a lot of ways about how you can't help but growing up, like it's going to happen. And like this idea of like loss of innocence as a good or bad thing. So the fact that you have that scene where all of these ghosts are just around him like any second now, and it makes you feel that like, oh no. But also, I mean, there's nothing you can do. You cannot help but grow up.
Yeah. And that metaphor really maps onto like human beings as well, talking about the origins of the subtle knife and the fact that like humans could not leave well enough alone. I thought that was just really fascinating. And then too, in the scene where Mary is communicating with the specters, they are talking about, you know, like rebel angels, the fact that angels intervened in human intervention. And there's just like so many ways in which like I just have this memory or impression, I should say, of the angels as like of human consciousness, but made into, you know, those like models from chemistry class where you built a like complex atom with, you know, like little Lincoln logs and like Lego pieces. That's how I pictured the angels, only instead of the pieces, you know, they're like thought and feeling and emotion and like a higher evolved, like in literally more dimensions version of human beings. So I was thinking about that too throughout the reading. Is like, you know, individual lives, you know, you get more complex, you get more ambitious, but so do species. And so apparently do like whole kind of levels of like being in the world and the metaverse.
I sort of related to that. I like that you have this moment where Ruta Scotti, who is my least favorite character in this book, she's on the Discord, this like the only thing that I came to complain about is anything pertaining to her. But she has this bit where like she is talking to these angels and they are thinking about how, like previously we have seen the witches look at humans and think how young and naive humans seem, and to then have this witch encounter the angels and like, you know, feel very fierce and wise with all her years. And then we see the angels looking at her with kind of that same level of like, oh, you're so young and naive.
Yeah, it was really nice. And I You know, this is kind of like a whole different podcast is the you know, taking seriously the sort of like claims or like we were saying earlier, I don't really care what Philip Pullman is trying to tell me
right
here. But I was reminded, too, of like C.S. Lewis writes really movingly about Christianity. And you might have guessed from the Chronicles of Narnia that he is, you know, interested in writing about Christianity as like in metaphor and via metaphor. And so he uses a lot of like real life metaphors for his understanding of like God and religion, specifically within Christianity and Christian kind of worldview. And I think it's just very like useful and interesting. And I don't know, anyone who's read both of these texts, like, please talk to me about your impressions of them, because I could not help but think of his like nonfiction about Christianity as I read these things, just because it was such an interesting way of making these like really intangible ideas into metaphors of like stuff you can touch and buses and like mm-hmm. atoms and all these mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm. I have read both. I grew up reading the Chronicles of Narnia, and it's a comparison you can't help but make, because I mean, people make it, and I knew that people made it before I even read these books, but also just because of the way that these books both use metaphor to tackle things about religion. And I think I don't remember a lot from my first read. So I kind of remembered the angels, but also here, I know we don't care what Philip Pullman is trying to say, but one of my like main gripes is that I can't help but like hear what he's trying to tell me in this book. It's so loud. It is so loud in this book, particularly. Yeah. And it just was interesting to me that his, like, he is an atheist, and some of what he's doing is deconstructing like Christian ideas and like organized religion, but he's doing it by basically being like, angels are real. I just think it's kind of funny. I know. I'm like, oh, okay, all right. But
like the author who brought you, hey, I'm just gonna call this church the church, I trust you'll get it. The fact that he chose to have the plot twist be that angels are real in the second book was definitely unexpected.
I don't know. Did you guys also feel though that like the messaging was a little heavier in this one?
I definitely think so.
Or are you just like, so I don't care what Philip Pullman is telling me, that you can like ignore it?
No, I mean, I definitely think the messaging is stronger in this one. It is definitely more present here than I think in the last one. And then in the first book. And I think that in the last one, there is also a lot more messaging, but it tends to come up a little bit more organically. Here, it becomes a bit of a mixed bag. Like, I think there are some really good kind of thesis statement moments in the conversation that Lee Scoresby and Grumman have shortly before they get attacked. And like that stuff flowed really well and worked wonderfully for me. Like, you know, it's Lee talking about, you know, you should, you know, fight evil wherever you find it. And Grumman talking about, you know, life being hard, but we cling to it all the same. And like that worked really well. I mentioned this before, but like Rita Scotti, every time she shows up to talk about how great Lord Asriel is, that stuff is always like, what are you doing? Like, I don't understand. Like, why are you so obsessed with him? And usually it's to talk about like, wow, like everything he's doing is like so impressive and amazing. And I mentioned this in the Discord, but like I have this theory that Lord Asriel is Philip Pullman's like self-insert Gary Stu character.
Oh, totally.
Right? And then we meet Rita Scotti, who's like supposed to be even hotter than Serafina Pecola, and she's like, yeah, I banged him. Like, I don't know. And is like super obsessed with him. And I just, every time she appears, it's to talk about how great he is. I don't know. I have a lot of feelings about that. But I
would
like,
rather
those are
learn
the places.
About any witch than about Lord Asriel.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
He's not even in this book, and we have to hear about him so much. I'm like, I know
right.
He's like doing a whole big thing, but I don't care. It's very strange to me, like, what Lord Asriel's whole character, because I in my impression and what I can remember and having read two books and kind of three, but not really, because I don't remember, like, you're almost supposed to think that, or most of our characters are on his side and believe what he's doing, but also he's the worst. It's really interesting to me that Pullman made the worst character at the head of like what we're supposed to be is the right cause. And we know he's the worst because he's the worst to Lyra, and you gave us the most precious child and like a dirtbag dad. We're not going to root for that guy. Are we supposed to root for that guy?
Yeah, I kept finding myself like flipping back in the book to be like, did I miss why the witches think that Lord Asriel is right? Like, did I miss why why, you know, everyone is so sure that Lyra is the fulfillment of this prophecy, or there's just a lot of like going after the thing that you know somehow to be right. And I don't know, like, to me, the alethiometer is the only source of truth, you know, or like Mary communing with the angels is the only source of like capital T truth. And so there are just a lot of like allegiances. There really is this feeling of like there is a war happening and I don't know how I know that I'm on this side. But this is the one I'm firmly on. So I'm going to like throw everything I have behind it.
Which that like it is, there is sort of a weird feeling of like, I don't entirely understand. I don't know. There are sort of two pieces to that. Like on the one hand, I get what Mari is saying in terms of, I do not understand why I should be rooting for Lord Asriel. But the sort of other side of it, like, I think it makes a certain kind of sense though, this idea that there's a war going on and like, I've just sort of been swept up into it. And like, I'm on a side now, you know? So like that doesn't bother me in quite the same way as the book positioning Lord Asriel as somebody that I should be rooting for or caring about in any meaningful way, because I don't.
I guess I kind of like rankled a little bit at it because I love so much people showing up for each other, not because they have to, but because they want to. Mm. And so having like the whole Lee plot line, like coming through for each other because you're like nice people, it's the right thing to do. Having the Armored Bears, you know, and Lyra's kind of allegiance in the first book. And even like Pan and Lyra showing up for each other or for Will. I don't know, like to me, those are the relationships that I'm really here for. And without the knowledge of like why these sides have fallen and shaken out the way that they are, or like the angels coming to like pilgrimage to see Will and Lyra, is like a moving and interesting image. But to me, like, I don't know, I'm just here for individual character relationships. So seeing the like metaphysical play out again in memory, it's a lot more effective because I see a lot more of that shake out in individual ways in Amber Spyglass. But in the meantime, like, I remember waiting between the publication of this book and Amber Spyglass, and it was like the longest I had ever waited. It was, you know, like 5 years or something. And as a kid, I was like, this is half my life. And I understand how it felt that way, because coming at the end of this book, waiting for the next one, like, I didn't even know it was coming, and yet I knew that it was like so much on the horizon.
The other thing that like sort of perplexes me almost about the way that Lord Asriel is put forth as, you know, someone to root for or whatever, is that like ultimately this isn't about him, you know, like this is sort of happening in the background. And I think it's kind of, I don't know, I really enjoy the bit where Grumman is, there's a bit late in the book where he is thinking about the importance of Lord Asriel's project and, you know, how he's got to get the, you know, the knife bearer to him. And I think by this point in time, the reader has been given enough clues to figure out that like this is Will's dad. He obviously doesn't know this yet. It's before he finds him, but he is really determined that like this is going to be his last big act, is getting the knife to Lord Asriel, and like the two of them, like he's going to do this big important thing for Asriel, who's also going to do this like other super important thing. But like actually what's happening here is that their kids are way more important than either of them. And I don't know, so on the one hand, it's like a little bit confusing to me, the sort of the way in which Lord Asriel is positioned as somebody that anybody would root for. On the other hand, I like this sort of piece of it. This is a weird comparison for me to be making because I love these books and I did not care for this episode of Buffy, but it kind of reminds me a little bit, like that moment made me think of the Zeppo, the Xander episode where like Xander, you know, like there's like an apocalypse happening kind of in the background, and then like what, like we're sticking with Xander. It felt a little bit like that, but like well done, you know, and like with two characters that I actually cared about. Or, you know, like you get this sense that like these adults are, they think that they're having, you know, this big important mission that they're going on, but the thing that actually really matters is the what's happening on the ground with these two children, you know, not the like higher level stuff that these adults are focused on. I don't know, I'm not sure if I articulated that correctly, but I enjoyed that little moment.
Yeah, it's not about you, parents.
Right.
It made me start thinking about the moms as well, and how Miss Coulter and Will's mom are so different, and how, I don't know, this is one part that felt icky to me, was when Philip Pullman was kind of trying to talk about the like soulless people in the in-between world, and Will was trying to rationalize his mom's, like, I don't know what's going on with his mom, but he was trying to say that then that's what's happening to her. And I was like, I don't like this.
I didn't think that the book was saying that that was what was happening to her at all. To me, I read that like that. I like that moment because that to me is like Will trying to make it make sense. I didn't read that as the book actually making that comparison. Like, it seems pretty clear that, you know, like there's no reason to believe that this is the same thing, especially because he literally talks about how sometimes she's lucid and sometimes she's not. And like, so that's clearly meaningfully different than what's going on with the specters. This is like a little boy trying to make sense out of these terrible things that he's witnessed. So
it's tragic. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the like to Connor's point, I also didn't read it that way. I thought it was Will kind of connecting his world to these things that he's now seeing in his world. And, you know, he even has a great line at the very beginning where he says that just because some of these things are happening in her head doesn't mean that they're any less real. So I think that we establish that he kind of knows that, you know, some of this is her problems in her brain. I think that maybe the book could have done, I'm trying to think for the intended audience, if there was some level of like, no, that's not true, that the book could have put in there to make clear to maybe a younger audience that, you know, this woman is not being haunted by ghosts, but, you know, that sometimes people's brain chemistry goes a little wrong or whatnot. So from that perspective, I could see it, but I also did read it as Will trying to justify or trying to explain to himself what was happening with his mom.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, I was just like throwing that out there because I was like, this was weird and wasn't ever like shut down fully. It was like he's still holding on to hope, although that makes sense because he's a little kid and he wants his mom to be like okay and he wants to save her or whatever. But yeah, I don't know how they would have made it more blatant because Will is so secretive of what is his and he just like wants to keep his mom safe from everyone. That's like all he's done his entire life. And the only time he ever allows anyone to pry is when he asks Lyra to check in on her, but just the one time.
Right.
So that makes sense.
I also straight up mixed up Mrs. Cooper and Mrs. Coulter in the first chapter of this book, and I was like, no, you cannot leave your mom with Lyra's mom. She is the worst. No.
She will not be safe.
Not safe. I got some Privet Drive vibes of like a Spy Among Us. Oh no, no good. I also really love the construction of, I called it Sitagazi. You think that's wrong? That's how my like 8-year-old brain pronounced it, of the medium world, the scary specter world.
That's how my 27-year-old brain pronounces it too.
Okay, good. Well, I really loved the conception of this world. It was obviously really cool to find this like liminal space. I'm just a fan of liminal spaces in general. But I thought that this conception of like an abandoned kind of scavenging, you know, kids amok, like orphans and kind of specters. And I really loved the way that we get to have this third world where we thought we knew the world of these books. And then, oh, wait, suddenly it's modern day England as well. And having this third place that is, you know, kind of like more about the realities of staying alive, because it's not the like prosperous you know Oxford in which we first met Lyra, but it's also a lot more kind of metaphysical, dangerous, like unwritten rules, things that are not common in this present world. I just thought it was a really cool foil to both of the other worlds that we get to experience.
I liked it from the angle of, you know, Pullman messing with our ideas of right and wrong. And he very explicitly says through Mary in this book, like, I don't want to think about good and evil. Like, I literally ran away from the church. Mary did to get away from the question of like good and evil. And the way that the way that he makes that gray area happen here is that you have this world of just children who we've been told are without, you know, original sin. They're without dust. They're the innocent ones. And they're walking around with guns and knives, like kill, kill, kill in this like abandoned area. So it's like, okay, wait, hold on. You don't have dust, but you're like, you know, so he starts making the reader question what is good, what is evil, and graying those lines. And those savage little children in the in-between place were a great way.
As an aside, the kill, 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 I like highlighted this because the audiobook is like that of that moment is very intense and terrifying to hear a bunch of children in your ears screaming kill, kill, kill. Was a lot. No. But yes, 100%. It is a really interesting way to like further problematize this question of good and evil.
I think the portal cutting is neat. I really liked the Scooby-Doo style, like robbing of the house. The whole idea that like both of these kids have their important items taken from them at all times. It felt very much like an unending D&D quest where you have to like get one item to get the next item, to get the third item, to get the fourth item, to like complete the first quest. And so that made me a little bit frustrated on their behalf, in the way that like every time a hero keeps missing the thing that will get them to the end, you're like, no, please don't. And then you're like, oh, wait, it has to have conflicts. It's a story. But I thought the portals were really cool. And as a kid, I always wanted that ability to be able to like stick my arm out, you know, while in bed and like get something out of the fridge and like take it back through the portal.
I really like that the portals actually had like some structure to them. Like it goes from one point in one world to that exact point in the next world. So you had to like physically move also. Like he had to like count how many steps he had to move to get to the bookcase so that he could have the portal as close as possible. I thought that was really cool.
I also just want to say this is like the third or fourth time in this conversation that we have brought up something that like becomes meaningful in the last book. And this reminds me of Mari's point about the sort of like slow but deliberate way that Pullman world builds. And like, it's all like it's like the pieces. There are pieces and they're there. And like they make sense when you're getting them. But then later you're like, oh, wait, they make even more sense. and it's like very lovely and good.
The first part where I was like, oh, Pullman with his pacing was that when we first got introduced to the subtle knife, which is what this book is named after. And it was literally like 53% of the way through the story. And I was like, oh, my God, it took us more than half of the story to get to the point where we even know what the subtle knife is.
Oh, yeah, no. I was like, I was 2/3 of the way through the book where I was like, wait, but when does Mary like redacted like do cool thing that I remember her for? And it's definitely a, I don't know, it's like tightly paced in some ways, but to me, all the unending, like we're almost there, but then the yometer gets taken. We're almost there, but then the knife is missing. It just felt a little bit frustrating.
I think it's funny because we were saying in the podcast for the first book, we were talking about how this is kind of talked about as a middle grade book, but it is pretty dark. So it's like a judgment call on whether like younger readers should read it, like it's determined on the age of the reader and the maturity of the reader and everything like that. I thought it was interesting in this one because it is so dark. You're talking about all these horrific things happening of people's souls being ripped from their bodies, but then it would have like stupid, silly, funny moments like them being like, this is the subtle knife. It's like, okay, got it. And like one part of Min Lee is like worrying about his demon. I forgot her name, Hester. And he's like talking about like, he's like, gosh, Lee, why are you so jumpy? And I was like, oh my God, your demon is a rabbit. Like,
you mentioned two things that are related in my mind, which is the fact that this is a middle grade book ? And also Mary Malone, who we haven't talked about at all. And this is something that I think, I don't know, the more times that I read this book, the more invested I am in Mary Malone as a character. And I don't know, some of this is just like, I'm in my 30s and I'm like, you know, career, like that's like the main thing I got going on in my life is my job. So I don't know, like relatable. She becomes more relatable to me as I get older and the children less relatable, maybe is what's going on there. But also like there are just lots of things about her story that the sort of side quest that she goes on in redacted, like that stuff is all super interesting and fun, whatever. But reading this book, I was struck by both how much I care about her, but also how much I feel like she would be super boring to a child. I don't know. Really, Amanda, I want to ask you what you remember about reading Mary as a child, because I couldn't stop thinking, like, if I were a kid, I would not care. I'd be so bored.
I think I was really interested in computers, so that part of it interested me. I also liked seeing a woman with a job who was not someone's wife or a witch. So that was cool. And reading it at 27, I was like, yes, Lyra, look, you can have a career and you don't have to become a narcissistic tyrant like your mom. Being a witch is awesome, though I don't know if you're going to be able to do that. So that's good just from a like representation point of view. I mostly remembered Mary for the stuff she does in the book after this, which is more active narrative. It's not about her in her like professional capacity in which Lyra meets her. Right. And it's about like experiencing, I think I can say this without any kind of spoilage, but Mary gets to experience something new and kind of go on like a journey of discovery and also document what she's seeing. And like that part as like a baby aspiring librarian is really what spoke to me about Mary. But yeah, I mean, reading it now, you know, it's not that like Lyra encounters something cool in Mary. It's that Mary gets visited by Lyra. And like, right. This is really where I see like Lyra as a prophetic figure. You know, like Lyra glides in there like a Victorian ghost and just like tells Mary things and asks her strange questions and then like leaves forever. So there, yeah, I think it's very much not that she's like learning stuff from Mary, but that Mary is like visited and irreparably changed.
I'm really interested. I feel like Mary Malone is going to be like the parents on the OC for me. That's a really strange connection, but the parents on the OC, I remember watching the OC and caring zero about them, revisited it for Snark Squad. And I was like, parents. and I feel like I'm going to have a similar experience because the first time I read it and Mary Malone's whole side quest, I was like, come on, like get on with it. So I'm curious how that will change, especially because I thought it was amazing that she gets like put on this quest in a matter of moments just because Lyra like came in and was like, what is this? And asking questions and showed off her skills or whatnot. And I also like very highly related to her being like, I don't know, I'm tired. I'm going to entertain this because
my funding got pulled for fucking research. But yeah, it's a much more sudden call to adventure and one that she accepts a lot more, like with a lot more kind of knowing and like being informed as to what that would actually mean for her life. It was really striking because Lyra almost like literally falls into this journey for herself and Will too, like has no choice in the matter. Like he's just here. He has to roll with the punches. But Mary is like, yes, I see this call to adventure and I am running for it.
And I think that it's also she wanted to know those things, but also like there is that threat of whatever that guy's name was, Sir Charles. Like, he's a bad guy, and she definitely got the vibe that he was not going to be okay with her knowing everything that was happening and then, like, dipping out of the project. So it was, like, a twofold. One, I want to figure out what's going on and figure out why this dark matter is able to talk to me. And also, like, I don't want to die.
Right. So, little push, little pull.
I definitely think that she was a little boring towards the beginning because everything was happening to her. And then the moment that she like makes the connection with the dust or dark matter or whatever and it's like, okay, I'm going on this adventure, and like tricks her way through the portal or like about to be through the portal. It's like, okay, let's do this. I like you now. I can read about you.
Yeah.
This makes me think we talked just a little bit ago about like sides on the war and how people are choosing. And it makes me think or realize that a lot of people are choosing just not what side they're on, but what side they're not on. So Mary Malone was like, you're clearly weird and evil. And so I'm going to go do this adventure thing. Lee's like, are you on Lyra's side or not on Lyra's side? That's like his guiding force. Even the witch was like, I don't know, the church is set up against Lord Azrael. Wherever the church is, that's where I don't want to be. We need to be on the opposite side.
Yes.
So a lot of people are just like falling on where they can clearly see wrong and going and doing the opposite thing, which I think is pretty interesting now that I thought of it right
now.
Sometimes
that's enough.
I mean, that happens in real life too.
All the time.
Right. I mean, like, and that is not necessarily like, it's not like a bad thing to say, right? Like the thing that I want to do is not that. And even, you know, in lower stakes scenarios, this is still like a useful thing that, you know, sometimes you don't know what the thing you want to do is, but you definitely know what the thing you don't want to do is. And so like, it makes sense.
Literally how I choose lunch every day. What don't I want to eat?
Yeah. I was just thinking about lunch.
It's a great method for choosing your lunch and sides in a great epic war. Same.
And like, and political involvement too. Like, whatever this is, I don't want it. Let's figure out how to do something else.
Yes. We have talked like about and around Lee. Like, we've mentioned Lee a bunch of times, but I just want to take a moment to like actually discuss how much we all love Lee.
Yes.
If you don't love Lee, you can leave now. This is the only correct opinion.
Connor, do you love Lee?
I do. He's awesome.
Okay, great.
Well, he was awesome.
I love him too much. I can't talk. I'm too overcome.
That's basically it.
No, yeah, I literally was like, okay, when final thoughts come, I just want to wrap up by saying how much I love Lee. Like his entire little journey and how much he was like fighting for Lyra. And it was so tragic, not only because he dies at the end, but also because the entire time he's fighting for something that already has happened. Like he's trying to get Lyra this protection and she's already there. And he just keeps saying about how if he had kids, he would want them to be half of what Lyra was. It was like every time he was saying these things, like the knife went a little deeper into my heart. Uh-huh. So
he was like, I just want to be like a substitute dad for her. And I was like, I want you to too.
And there's this little moment too where he is getting indignant with Grumman about he is like reacting to like something that Grumman said, and like he's a little bit frustrated with like, you know, not getting all the information, and something about the way that he is getting indignant with him felt very much like Lyra to me too. And so I don't know, the fact that like he's obviously not actually related to her, but like then you see the sort of similarities in their personality, I was like, oh, this is so sweet and precious and good.
There's also that moment where he makes John Perry like swear that he will do this one last thing and get Lyra some protection, and he's like, if you don't, whatever's left of me will haunt your ass. And I was like, yeah, Willie. like I don't know, he just has so many endearing moments that, and I came away with this primarily with like an unending love for Lee Scoresby.
I know, there's so much good writing. Like he says in the end, like, oh, I can't shoot a man in the back. And then Hester said, can't really die with one bullet left though either. And it's just like their dynamic is perfect. And I remembered that last scene almost word for word. Like it really had an impression on me. It's like, it's the horrors of war. It's the love of them for each other and the dedication to Lyra and like the tragedy of it all. And I can't engage with this.
But how excited are we all to see Lin-Manuel Miranda play Lee Scoresby?
I'm like, so excited. God.
That means I have to see him die like this.
No, I don't want it. True. Good point. Good counterpoint.
First thing I thought when I saw the casting, I was like, I can't handle this. I'm going to close my eyes.
Gonna have to fast forward through it.
No, it'll be really exciting.
I have just one other final little thing, which is a little bit embarrassing for me to kind of confess, but we were talking about something in the group chat and the Discord, and Nicole said her comment was about how each of the three totem items in the series, like the Golden Compass, the Subtle Knife, and the Amber Spyglass, and she made some point, but I had that moment where I was like, I have never noticed that the three books are named for these things. And it was especially like I don't know, mind-blowing for me because the Golden Compass is a U.S. thing. It was the Northern Lights, which the Northern Lights are not a totem item in the series.
Right.
And a lot of people feel very strongly against the Golden Compass. And I think we even were like, no, it's an alethiometer. It's not even a compass. But I take all of that back because the fact that each book is named after one of these items is great. And that is the right choice.
Yeah, but it still bothers me. It's bothered me for like 21 years that it's not the Silver Knife. Like, yes, that is a bad book title, but it's Gold, Subtle, and Amber. That's not three colors. That's not three metals. That is nothing.
Okay,
you're so
concede.
Close. Give me three or none at all.
I concede. You have the better point.
I think that there is a lot to talk about too, though, with like the three objects, but I think it's better to save that conversation for the next book when we can talk about all three of them.
I can't wait.
And on that note, we have come to the end of another episode. Thank you to Amanda and Connor for joining us this week, and thank you all for listening. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on The Subtle Knife. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on Patreon, where there are polls, live hangouts, and other bonus content, and that's at patreon.com/snarksquad. You can also find us on Twitter at snark_squad. I am at My Name Is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
I'm at She's So Mickey.
And I'm at Connor Booking It.
Thank you as always to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. We will be back in your feed next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.